Welcome to Serve and Volley, the tennis podcast for people who like arguments. I'm Nick.
I'm Pavel.
So, welcome back to Serve and Volley. First up, the baseline. What are the big stories, Pavel? Rotterdam?
Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks since we last recorded an episode, so that gives you us a bit more to talk about than usual. Rotterdam, it's a good starting point, I guess, the first 500 of the year.
Right, and a surprise winner, we would say.
I think a pleasant surprise. I think you must be one of the most beloved players on tour.
Yeah, and I saw, I can't remember where the tournament was, but Songa winning a couple of weeks earlier.
Mets, kind
of
both or something.
Yeah, both kind of slightly unlikely, but kind of like enjoyable kind of aging French players. So yeah, Monfils sort of rejuvenated in Rotterdam. Who did he beat in the final?
Oh, Wawrinka, another.
Yeah. All right, and who did he beat in the semis?
So Wawrinka beat Kanish Corey and Monfils beat Medvedev.
Medvedev.
And Tsonga, right. Oh yeah, Tsonga lost to Medvedev in the quarters. Right. I remember he also did quite well in the tournament.
So Monfils beating Wawrinka in the final, that's a good final, eh?
That is a throwback for, you know, all the tennis.
It's not really
lovers.
A throwback. I mean, Monfils, 2 years ago was in the World Tour finals for the first time. You know, he's relatively near the top of his game, really. And Wawrinka, you know, I think could have a much better
season. But it does kind of tie in with our previous assertions that the next gen are really just a bit of a marketing bubble. And yeah. Although that said, you know, Tsitsipas didn't win a tournament this week.
Yeah, Tsitsipas winning in Marseille.
Yeah.
But that's a tournament he would be expected to win, given, you know, the quality of the opposition there. I mean, he was the top seed. Who do you play in the final? Someone?
Kukushkin.
Yeah, Kukushkin. So, I mean, that's a tournament he should win. It's not like Monfils coming into Rotterdam. I think Monfils has been rejuvenated in part by his relationship with Elina Svitolina.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's a great piece of tennis gossip for...
It's
probably past gossip, but
they've gone so hard for it. I mean, do you follow their Instagram account, The Gems?
Do they have a shared Instagram? So they have
a shared branding, which is Gems, GEMS, like Gael, Elina, Monfils, Svitolina. And yeah, they post every day, like posts of them. It's like really, I mean, like mundane, like
very attractive couple
stuff. Yeah, I think they're cool. They're the kind of the glamorous couple of tennis now. And I actually, it does seem to feel like Monfils is like upping it a little bit. You've got to impress your younger girlfriend.
So would you say that the Monfils Wawrinka match was a derby of over 30 players with young blonde Eastern European girlfriends?
Yeah, it would make a very good mixed doubles, kind of like battle royale.
Like your average Sunday at the club, you know, with the wives and the wags.
Yeah. We've also got we're recording on Sunday and got Delray Beach, which is of interest to me as a fan of British tennis. Because Dan Evans has made it to the final, beating Tiafoe and Isner along the way, two kind of Americans in America, which is always very pleasing.
Yeah, Tiafoe is the defending champion. I'm pretty sure Isner has won Delray Beach a couple of times. I have to say, I was, you know, quite skeptical about Dan Evans, but since his comeback, he's really impressed me. So it's actually something that we don't disagree on that much. I think he's got a very fun style. He comes to the net a lot, and despite, you know, being 178, not, you know, a tall, big guy who comes to the net to kind of finish off big serves, but actually just having great hands and using that in the modern game, that's really refreshing. And obviously anyone who beats John Isner is a friend of mine.
It's nice to see a player play with quite like a... with just someone who's like quite talented at the sport and probably hasn't... You know, something we'll discuss Nick Kyrgios a little bit in the next section. But I quite like players who are playing all from talent rather than like their dedication to the sport.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like the anti-Roberto Bautista Gutz.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure RBA is a very nice man, but, you know, the kind of the flashy, less hardworking players. You know, I have a weak spot for Bruno Tomic and Ernest Gulbis and Nick Kyrgios, which we will come to shortly. But otherwise, what are the other big stories the last couple of weeks? I mean, Rio finals are also on tonight. Félix Auger-Aliassime has reached his first ATP final. He's, you know, he's hovering on the outside of the top 100. Now he's in the top 60. He's 18. He's from Canada.
Canada have got some talent coming through.
Yeah, he's, you know, it's both exciting times for Canadian tennis with Raonic and Shapovalov and Pospisil. So they've got four top 100 players. Well, they've got four top 100 players. I mean, that's, I think, more than they've had probably cumulatively over the last decade or so. Félix Auger-Aliassime has won a challenger tournament at age 16. He's been quite a kind of talked about next almost like next gen talent. He's born in the 21st century. Which
next gen, are you going to copyright that?
Just next squared. Yeah, well, he is, you know, born in this millennium, which is depressing for all of us mid-20s people. But, you know, I haven't seen him play that much. I've seen him play a bit and, you know, good kind of all-round player. In a very white sport, it's also nice to see a mixed-race man doing well, which is kind of, you know, on top of Monfils and Tiafoe as well. And it's always nice to kind of have a bit of balance.
Yeah, and it does feel like younger players, there is actually a much better... I mean, one of the people we should talk about now is Naomi Osaka, who we discussed in some detail last week and who has kind of fallen slightly into the kind of vortex that I described in my... As I didn't have this data for it, but like the fact that people who do very well in Grand Slams at the start of the year tail off. And that was true of Poirier. That was true of Tsitsipas, who, I mean, he's now won in Marseille, but he went out in Rotterdam very early.
Yeah.
And Osaka has had a bit of a shocker, but most notably, she split from her coach, Sasha Bajin. You're the pronunciation expert.
I'll go with you on that one. I actually have no inside information. Yeah, that is one of the big stories the last couple of weeks. Any thoughts?
Yeah,
we did not see that coming. We probably should have addressed that in our backhanded compliment section. We should have just ended it with it coming.
I mean, it seemed like it was very out of the blue, and the whole tennis world seems to be rocked by the loss of a coach. It feels like players exchange coaches quite regularly.
Certainly. But usually it's on off the back of, you know, a run of disappointing results rather than winning two majors back to back. Apparently, after the news came out, people kind of went back and saw her talk about him in the post-AO press conferences, and she was actually very kind of cold and didn't have the same enthusiasm for his coaching that she did after the US Open. So something must have happened in the off-season. We can only speculate, or probably we shouldn't speculate.
We probably shouldn't speculate. It's been a difficult subject to address because it feels like there are rumours and there are insinuations and stuff, and there's very little concrete. But what is certainly the case is that she's saying that the kind of the media scrutiny on this has actually impacted her game, and she had a pretty shocking loss to...
Oh, she lost to Kristina Mladenovic, who, you know, is a bit of a wild card.
Yeah, and another member of our sort of tennis player mixed doubles.
Oh,
are they not together anymore?
I do not.
Oh, no, I hope so.
No, I think they're very much together.
Thank God. Because obviously this is both it's mainly a tennis romance podcast we do. We discuss all the
The main romance being between Nick and me, of course, although his girlfriend might have something to say
about that. That's the
real romance. Yeah, no, I mean, Mladenovic is obviously one of the best women's doubles players in the world. In singles, she has had her ups and downs. She was in the top 20 and reached the French Open quarter or semifinal a couple of years ago. But since then, you know, has declined. But yeah, she does have this upset in her. But yeah, Osaka obviously hasn't, you know, followed up Australian Open with any kind of dominance. But we'll see how she does in the Sunshine Double on her home turf.
Mm.
I think, obviously, splitting from a long-term coach is always going to be a bit destabilizing, but I'm sure she'll be the tennis media will have moved to something else, so if she doesn't enjoy the scrutiny, she'll probably be, you know, relieved in a couple of months when there'll be something else to talk about.
And I guess the other big story is the draw for the Davis Cup, but we'll be discussing that in the third part of the show, so let's move on, I guess. So it's time for backhanded compliments. And this week we're discussing a man who's very dear, I think, to both of us.
There is some evidence that suggests that you like people who have the same first name as you, which is why Nick likes Nick Kyrgios. Certainly, Nick Kyrgios simultaneously manages to be very precocious in terms of his tennis ability, having reached Grand Slam quarterfinals as a teenager. I think nobody's done that since him in 2014, something like that, when he beat Nadal in Wimbledon. Yeah. And simultaneously being very immature and, you know, looking at other players who are aged the same as him or even younger and just kind of getting on with it. I don't know. Borna Coric, I think, is quite a good example of someone who just kind of goes out there and plays, and it probably isn't the most talented player out there, although he's, you know, fairly talented. But
yeah, there are a handful of the quite workmen. I mean, Carl Edmund is another one of these people who's like...
Yeah.
Kyrgios has so much more about him, and that match he exploded onto the scene against Nadal at Wimbledon, it is like an iconic match. I mean, he just has the capacity to excite in a way that few players do, but he's now, what, 26?
No. He was born 95, so he would be either 23 or just turned 24.
But he's now almost 24, and he's currently ranked number 64 in the world, which is crazy that Nick Kyrgios is world number 64. That isn't right.
Mikhail Kukushkin, who briefly mentioned earlier, is now ranked 41 in the world. His career best, you know, if you can tell me anything about Mikhail Kukushkin.
He's from Kazakhstan.
He is from Kazakhstan. I think that can be confirmed very easily. But, yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of players ahead of Kyrgios who don't possess his natural talent, who've just kind of, we're journeymen who've been around for a long time.
I mean, he also has achieved more in the game than that. He has a better slams record than that kind of gives him credit for, right? It's just getting motivated. This week we saw him, and I guess this is the sort of why we're talking about him now, is we saw him at Delray Beach, and it was kind of another pathetic display of kind of tanking.
Well, he did lose to Albot, who's now in the final. So
it's the manner in which he lost. I mean, I don't know if you saw some of what was going on. Again, on court, he was rowing with himself, like clearly not taking it seriously at points, like kind of like laughing and sort of hitting, you know, trick shots and these kind of no effort slap shots, which sometimes when they come off they look great. When it's like his, you know, he'll return a really fast serve with just a kind of flick of the wrist, but it's actually really typical of someone who's like not that focused, not that invested in the point. And that's obviously been his big thing, is that when things are going badly he just kind of relies upon being essentially silly.
Yeah, I mean, Kyrgios gets a lot of hate from certain circles. I think the Australian media particularly, because they resent the fact that this guy who has this big talent is wasting it, as if, you know, he somehow owes it to them to put more effort in than he does, when, you know, he only owes it to himself. And the things that are most frustrating about him are also the things that are most kind of intriguing. Like you mentioned, you know, he can just return serves really effortlessly and just hit ludicrous winners, hit tweeners, you know, just hit a lot of trick shots. But he is very inconsistent, especially over the last, you know, 6-12 months. He hasn't had these, you know, he had that really good run in Cincinnati where he beat Nadal in 2017, and then he lost kind of bloodlessly to Dimitrov. And since then, you know, apart from his performance in Laver Cup, which is obviously, you know, a glorified friendly, or not even glorified.
That really suits him.
Yeah,
he likes that team environment. It's why he would be a very good Davis Cup player. It's why Team Australia was so excited when they had Kyrgios and Tomic and Kokkinakis coming through, like really kind of exciting, good young talent. And then, you know, they've all turned out to be to slightly squander. I got in trouble actually once for writing an article in which I included Kokkinakis in that threesome of people who I thought were a bit kind of troublemaker, because he is by all accounts much more sensible than the other two, but just has had injury problems really more than anything. But it looked for a moment like Australia would have
under Vavrinka.
We're gonna maybe
cut that.
But, you know, Kyrgios seems like a player who is made for that, those sort of like team events.
Well, Kyrgios is a big fan of the NBA, in particular the Boston Celtics, and he's talked...
Big fan of Fortnite too.
That too. I think that's definitely been holding his game back in recent months. But generally, he has kind of said that he, even though he has all this natural talent for tennis, is actually not his favorite sport and he'd rather be playing basketball. And sometimes it just seems like he'd rather be doing anything else, including, you know, staring at a wall or playing tiddlywinks.
And that's something that Tomic has also said, like in press conference, just be like, I just don't enjoy it that much. It's just a job to me. Like,
well, Tomic has had this like drop out of the top 100 and then kind of worked his way up playing challenges and playing, you know, qualifiers for 250s, which... And now he's, you know, in the 80s somewhere, which is, I think, quite a good turn of events for him. You know, he actually has he's probably enjoying tennis more now because he's had to kind of work for it rather than just sliding into irrelevance. It's always good to have like an upward trajectory. Kyrgios is definitely now on a downward trajectory. He, like I said, since Cincinnati, he hasn't really had any results worth mentioning. He's had the occasional match where he was really impressive, but not, I don't think there's any tournaments where you would really say, wow, that Kyrgios. And he's also had some injury problems, although with him it's hard to tell whether he's actually hurting or, you know, just doesn't care. And then the injury is just a convenient excuse for him afterwards so that he doesn't get accused of tanking. This is a very shallow observation, but I think what we were talking about Monfils earlier, and it's just really nice to see certain players with great YouTube compilations. And you kind of want those players to be able to do that over the course of, you know, a match, a tournament, a year, a career.
Yeah.
And with both Monfils and Kyrgios, although Monfils has definitely achieved a lot more, there's a sense that, you know, they can do these absolutely brilliant things on court that even, you know, the big four would be very proud of. Ridiculous hand skills from Kyrgios, one of the best serves, I think, on tour when he's got it together as well. Really fast, really unusual in its technique, which makes it quite hard to read, I think, for players. Mm. But he's also, like, just doesn't put any effort into his return game. So even when Kyrgios is playing well, his matches often go into these kind of, you know, multiple tiebreaker sets. And that's just not a good... That means you just depend on a few points in a match.
Yeah.
That's just not a sustainable winning strategy.
Do we think he can get it together? Do we think he's going to be... You know, we are moving towards a period where the current dominant forces are going to be retiring and not challenging and not competing. He is only 23, almost 24. He's got another, you know, 10 years of professional tennis in him. Is he going to win Grand Slams? Or is this just evidence, if he's not capitalized at this point, that he probably doesn't have the psychological game to get up there?
Well, part of the problem is that it seems like he can only bring himself to care when there is someone really impressive on the other side of the net, which is why he's beaten Nadal a couple of times, which is why his matches against Federer tend to be very, very high quality, because I think he plays to the strength of his opponents. Whereas, you know, if he plays someone ranked in the 60s or 70s, and he's just kind of, he feels like he could beat that guy, but he just doesn't care, which is very immature, as I've said before.
Mm-hmm.
So actually the big four retiring might potentially even hurt him, because he won't feel like there's this like epic stage that he wants to play at. But if Bernard Tomic can, you know, pull it together and kind of start taking tennis a bit more seriously again, I don't see why Kyrgios can't, because I actually think he has probably a better home environment with, you know, a very supportive mum, whereas Tomic
had... A professional tennis player girlfriend?
Well, I think that is actually off at the moment.
I don't know.
They're kind of on-off. But yeah, that is another example of tennis power couple.
Yeah. I think, you know, with Kyrgios, I'm just like always ready for him to have an amazing 6 months and to just like get into a rhythm, get a bit of momentum and start feeling good about his game. And my feeling is also like, if he was actually like getting to Grand Slam semifinals and stuff, you'd see a sort of change in mentality. It wouldn't just be about getting himself up for, you know, because I think he can get himself up for the big matches against big players. But I also think that if he really saw himself as being someone who could compete for the biggest titles, you'd also get that. You'd get the same sort of response from him. So it's so hard to tell, though, is the thing. It's like an absolute coin toss.
And I mean, we're all rooting for him, I think it's fair to say. I think it's always
He would be a good player to... He's the right sort of player to do well.
Yeah.
And you know, if I live in a world, which I currently do much to my chagrin, where Kevin Anderson is a multiple Grand Slam finalist, yeah, I'm rooting for Nick Kyrgios to do well.
There you go. On to our final section, Courting Controversies, where we will be discussing the Davis Cup rule changes.
Yes. Well, you're going to have to explain them to me a little bit, because I am aware of it in a more general sense, but some of the intricacies, it's sort of like with the Nations League in football, some of the actual technicalities have escaped me. So first of all, just outline for people, whether they know or don't know, what the kind of biggest changes are.
I think the biggest change is that the Davis Cup used to be spread throughout the year and used to take place in different countries. I was never quite sure how the host country was decided, but whoever the host country was would pick the surface. So it was quite a different tournament based on whether it's, you know, being played on clay in Spain or on hard court in Russia.
Or grass in the UK.
Yeah, exactly. And that said, in recent years, you know, you've had quite kind of predictable winners in a way. You've had, you know, all the big four managed to grab themselves at least one Davis Cup, obviously more in the case of Nadal and Djokovic, because Spain and Serbia have, you know, more depth to their squads. You've also had Argentina win with Del Potro, again, decent depth team. And the most recent winners were Croatia with Cilic and Coric, you know, two top 15 players, and a fairly decent doubles record as well. So that was in the past where you kind of needed to win, surface intricacies aside. And it was usually, I think, first round, you know, winter, then second round spring, third round autumn, and then the final being actually, you know, the last match of the season, just after the tour finals. Whereas now Piquet...
Okay, put Piquet aside, because I think it's loaded to sort of talk about Piquet at this point. Explain what the format change is, though.
So they've decided to condense the Davis Cup, also put it in one geographic location, and make it much more like, you know, the Football World Cup or the Cricket World Cup, and just give it that kind of vibe.
And the controversy has been stoked by quite a few players saying they don't like these changes.
Yeah, I mean, tennis is a weird sport, right? Because I think generally we are quite traditional, us tennis fans. Obviously, you know, Nick is so traditional, he doesn't like hokkai, which is a point of contention. But the sport has had recent rule changes with, you know, the tiebreaks in the Australian Open, which we've already discussed. Mm. And, you know, there's always these kind of little innovations coming in, like the shot clock or, you know, the towel rack or, you know, whatever. There's always a bit of tinkering going on with the sport. And this is quite a big step. because the Davis Cup has won the most historic competitions in the world.
But it is also a competition that has taken a lot of criticism in the last few years from the top players, just for the way it's been organized, the way it's spread out over the year, the kind of commitment levels required, and also a lot of criticism from fans and the tennis public for, you know, the best players opting out of seasons of Davis Cup, seemingly. It's not been a mandatory experience for top players in the way that international sports should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think unlike football, which is an obvious, you know, go-to comparison, where players get paid loads by their clubs and then they play for their country as a matter of pride and to kind of, you know, raise their profile and then, you know, increase the value on the market when it comes to clubs. There's no such advantage with the Davis Cup. There's still obviously the glory, but that's...
But there's the same thing. I mean, like the Ryder Cup in golf is obviously much more... The golfers take that much more seriously. No one would ever countenance not accepting a Ryder Cup invitation. You know, most sports, you know, rugby, again, the market values, again, is not a huge thing in rugby, but you would never not turn up to the Six Nations. You know, most sports, international sport is something that players really want to do. And it was a kind of sign that something was slightly wrong with the Davis Cup, that so often top players were, and also in football, there are sanctions on players who refuse an international call-up. If you play in, you know, a FIFA-governed league, you aren't allowed to just reject a international call-up unless you're retired. And if you say you're injured, you're not allowed to play for your club again within, you know, a reasonable window. I think it's like 10 days or 2 weeks or something like that. You know, it just felt like the tennis world was not taking the Davis Cup that seriously, and certainly not taking the Davis Cup that seriously prior to the sort of semi-final, final period in the autumn. The early fixtures were almost always being sort of opted out of. And then if a big team was in danger of relegation, then maybe the big players would come back in just to stave off that threat. But I really thought that something was slightly kind of broken about the way the Davis Cup. I remember sitting there watching GB Serbia, watching them play in Belgrade in this absolute bear pit, and a great crowd there, and it was like the number one singles match was like Kyle Edmund versus Viktor Troitsky, and I was like, something is slightly wrong with this tournament structure if this is happening. I also thought that the spreading it out so much over the year doesn't really do anyone any favours. Much better to have it over a condensed period of time.
I don't know. I mean, there used to be a time, we can talk about root reasons maybe later, but there used to be a time when winning the Davis Cup for a lot of players was, you know, maybe even more of a priority than the Slams. You know, certainly there was a time when, you know, the Australian Open was seen as something kind of dispensed with in the calendar. But then, you know, there was these, obviously I wasn't alive for that, but I've read about these epic battles between the Australian and US teams in the Davis Cup and, you know, the 60s and 70s with your Rod Lavers and your Ken Rosewalds and on the one side and Arthur Ashe and so on the other. And that was seen as, you know, one of the biggest trophies a tennis player could win in their career. And definitely something has changed. Although, that said, like I said, most big names of recent years have backed themselves at Davis Cup, unless you happen to be like Grigor Dimitrov and you just come from a country with no tennis tradition whatsoever, in which case, why bother playing in Davis Cup for Bulgaria when you know that Bulgaria has no chance in the later stages of the tournament anyway?
There's only a pool of only potentially, in the current format, there is only how many teams are in the world group? 8?
Yeah, but there's promotion relegation, so...
Right. As long as you get past that first match each year, you know, Australia, USA, Spain, Switzerland, GB lately, Belgium, Argentina, Croatia, it's like a very small pool of people.
For instance, what I find interesting and is that Germany does have Zverev showing up and playing, and they just happen to either get a tough draw or just not perform to their level, depending on how you see it in recent years. But, you know, they did have Zverev, Kohlschreiber... The other Zverev.
But Zverev and Kohlschreiber as your singles points aren't...
Well, it's better than, whoever Britain had as the number two when they won it.
Maybe. But if you expect then Murray to get 2 points and then Edmund to get no points, then it just happened that GB had a good doubles pairing. That's where it comes down to. And I think that's the case in quite a lot of the Davis Cup teams that actually win. It's quite, you know, you split the singles points and then have a good doubles pairing, which is what Serbia...
Well, certainly Goffin managed to carry the Belgium team to 2 finals, even though they don't have, you know, anyone really behind them that, I mean, Steve Darcis or whatever, like, maybe that's not a serious contender for anything. Yeah. Although he has also beaten Nadal at Wimbledon.
But the Belgium was also a case of them doing, unless I'm much mistaken, getting an awful lot of home ties and playing them on clay outside of the clay season and sort of discombobulating everyone that way. So, you know, everyone's suspicious of this I think particularly because they've got this, it's the Piqué Cup, and, you know, Piqué is from a different sport and is sort of sticking his beak in where he shouldn't. And, you know, it feels like there's money concerns. This may all be true, and this may all be really valid criticisms, and it may be a rubbish format. I do think that something needed to change with the Davis Cup. I just didn't think it was a good, relevant format given the intensity of the tennis year, the modern tennis year. I think it maybe harked back to a time when players weren't traveling around the world so much, weren't playing as nearly as many tournaments, you know, where the financial incentives for most of these tournaments weren't as high as they are. So, and I think a change is good. I would have preferred to see the Davis Cup become something closer to the Laver Cup, something closer to the Ryder Cup in format, even happening every 2 years and making it much more valuable as a thing to win. There's nothing in tennis. There's no prize in tennis that isn't annual. And if you, other than the Olympics, yeah. And if you create a non-annual prize, suddenly you get a little bit of extra prestige because, you know, players only get 8 chances to win it in their career rather than 16, whatever. So I think that would have been how I would have gone. But I'm willing to give this new Davis Cup a chance.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason not to give it a chance. It's not like me not liking the format is going to help, you know, change it back. So I will.
But what do you instinctively not like about that format? Just spell out what it is that is upsetting you.
Well,
because you're sitting here in tears, and I just think it's a bit much.
Well, I'm also, I think they're kind of messing with the whole 5 sets tradition of it as well. And that's something I always liked about the Davis Cup, that outside of the Olympics final and the obviously the majors, it was the only competition that was still keeping the 5 set tradition alive. And I actually not that bothered about, you know, the other, you know, being spread throughout the tennis calendar is quite nice, kind of tuning in and out. But, you know, I think being a condensed version can work just as well. But we won't have the surface variety that we used to have. And I am a bit worried about, I'm not sure if is it becoming a 3-set tournament, or there's definitely some kind of changes that suggest that it's getting away, because it's going to be, you know, in a condensed time period, that it's going to be moving away from the 5-setters. And that's something I don't like, because I think that makes matches and tournaments more valuable in itself, because it's quite a rarity. And I do agree with your point that having a biannual Ryder Cup-esque event would be quite good. Although the Laver Cup has been partly as well of the Big Four all being European, or, you know, the Big Five if you count Stan Wawrinka, which might be a topic for another week. You know, Europe is a bit too dominant now for the rest of the world to really have a chance.
Yeah, well, that's really the rest of the world's problem.
Yeah, but I think when the US and the rest of the world and Europe were playing each other in the Ryder Cup, that was seen as prestigious competition, because the US just assumed that they would win it, and then Europe were like, hang on, you won't. Whereas I don't think there's that kind of sense of international pride in the rest of the world to really think, oh, we can take on Europe. I don't think, you know, I would love to see Nick Kyrgios and Jack Sock play more doubles together. I think that's a great pairing, because they're both very lazy, very talented players who are good in net. But, you know, the question is, will people care more about the Davis Cup now? And only time will tell. So I will give it the benefit of the doubt. But I'm not sure that the format changes actually address the root problem.
So just finally, it's taking place in Madrid this year on hard courts. It's going to be about a week long in November. They've just done the draw for the groups. Here are the groups. They're 3 team groups. Group A, France, Serbia, Japan. Group B, Croatia, Spain, Russia. Group C, Argentina, Germany, Chile. Group D, Belgium, Australia, Colombia. Group E, Great Britain, Kazakhstan, Netherlands. Group F, United States, Italy, Canada. What's the group of death there? Croatia, Spain, Russia?
That is a tough one, yeah.
France, Serbia, Japan. You've also got some. It seems like
there are some teams that have, you know, very weird additions to it, right? I mean, what are Kazakhstan, the Netherlands?
Yes, well, they're both mysteriously in a group with Great Britain.
Oh, is that the 3?
Yeah,
Great Britain is laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah, yeah.
And also Colombia. Chile and Colombia, I don't think are either particularly strong.
But maybe there's a geographical requirement to have a certain number of South American teams? It's funny that we only have 1 Asian team, although Kazakhstan, actually,
yeah.
I guess all.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some promising matchups in what you just described. I think, you know, Italy, Canada could be very entertaining. Just to pick a random,
you know, just you know that the World Cup finals are so much better than the World Cup qualifiers. And before, the Davis Cup felt like the World Cup qualifiers, like this kind of breaks from the norm, the rhythm of like the football season. You like everyone has to go off and become, oh, now we're interested in international football. And that was kind of what Davis Cup felt like. But that was the actual tournament. surely better to have an actual proper tournament that you can just sink your teeth into for a week and not worry about for the rest of the year, and not be like, oh, I really wish I was watching, you know, a good Masters 1000 tournament rather than this weekend of Germany versus Moldova.
I think this is a very provocative argument. I think the main difference is that when you watch club football and you watch countries play each other, I think we all kind of know that the best teams, club teams in the world of football are better than most national sides, just because, you know, they train together all year. And
yeah, but it's a different partisanship that you feel. It's about the response rather than the
exactly.
Actual...
There's a different partisanship, which is why I love the World Cup and I love the Euros, and I think I enjoy watching them more than any other tournament. But you can't make a like for like comparison, whereas you can make a like for like comparison between, you know, Djokovic playing Nadal in the Australian Open final, although that was a bit of an underwhelming match this year. And then the same thing happening in the Davis Cup final right at the end of the year, where everyone's just really knackered. And what motivation would they have for playing in that tournament at this point that they don't have now? I don't really understand why that would change. Again, I feel like, you know, you've
already
played them
for the viewers, and if you get a more intense cauldron of interest in it as a project, then yeah, necessarily players will feed off that. They're more invested in the Grand Slams because the Grand Slams are more prestigious, and the Grand Slams are more prestigious in part because they're the tournaments that people care about.
But what's a good example of any sport really making some big changes to the way it runs things and some having some new competition with new rules, and that actually enhancing the prestige?
Well, the obvious answer to that would be, and this is a tennis podcast, so I don't want to talk too much about football, but the Nations League renovations to European football teams' friendlies has been a triumph.
Has it?
Yeah.
I don't know anyone who cares about the Nations League.
No, like the consensus very much is not that we care that much about the Nations League, but that suddenly these meaningless friendlies that people really couldn't get any appetite for, they threw up some really, really good matches. In England's fixtures in the autumn, the game against Spain was one of the best England internationals in my lifetime. The Croatia last kind of comeback from 1-0 behind to win 2-1 and win the group and, you know, go through to this mini tournament in the summer. Another one of the best international matches I've seen England play in. So it just transformed something that everyone knew was a dud thing, which is like international friendlies where no one wants to get injured. People just want to test out some blood, some youngsters, test out a few new systems. That was always kind of crap for the players and for the viewers. And, you know, you added a new element. So, you know, I do think these formats can be renovated. It's a quite a subtle difference with the Nations League, but this could be a really good one if it works for the viewers. And I guess not having home fixtures is a problem, but it's a problem that most sports have solved in terms of how they deal with international competitions.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're much more bullish about the prospects of the new Davis Cup than I am, but time will tell.
Time will tell. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We should be available. If it's missing from anywhere, drop us a line, let us know. Follow us on Twitter @andvolley, no serve. And we'll be back next week.
See you then.